Hello, friends, and welcome to this edition of the Ames Tribune for Friday, January 29th. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. And our first story comes to us from Isabel Rosario. An additional 51 COVID-19 cases confirmed in Story County. The 14-day average positivity rate is at 5%. Another 51 new COVID-19 cases were confirmed in Story County from Wednesday to Thursday. The state's coronavirus website showed at 10 o'clock in the morning Thursday. At that time, state officials reported 8,921 positive cases in Story County, up from Wednesday's total of 8,870. No new deaths were reported. To date, a total of 38 Story County residents have died as a result of COVID-19, according to the Iowa coronavirus website. Of those who have tested positive for the virus in Story County, 8,026 have recovered, according to the state. As of Thursday, Story County's 14-day average positivity rate is 5%, down from 6% on Wednesday. To date, a total of 49,222 Story County residents have been tested for the virus. Across the state of Iowa, an additional 32 deaths and 1,264 coronavirus cases were reported on Thursday morning. At 10 a.m. Thursday, the state was reporting 4,532 COVID-19-related deaths in total, an increase of 32 since the state's tally 10 a.m. Wednesday. The state was reporting at 10 a.m. Thursday that there are 316,434 confirmed cases of coronavirus, an increase of 1,264 since Wednesday. Total number of people tested, 1,459,921. Total number of people tested who have recovered, 279,684. Our next story comes to us from Philip Sitter. Haven't seen his name as a writer with the Ames Tribune. He may be new, but Philip Sitter writes this article for the Ames Tribune. The Ames School Board votes to return grades 6 through 12 to fully on-site learning with a remote option. Middle and high school students in the Ames Community School District will return to 100% in-person learning Monday, with a remote learning option. After the district school board changed course this week following their decision the week before to remain in a hybrid learning model for grades 6 through 12. Board members said what changed since was not underlying concerns about social distancing or teachers being at risk until they can be vaccinated, but improving local COVID-19 data and likely action from the state that would force the district to return to 100% in-person learning anyway. At the Iowa State House, Republican lawmakers have been quickly pushing proposals to require schools to offer fully in-person learning model, and Ames board members expect Monday that a successful vote would come in a matter of days. Debate on the bills was expected on Thursday. Ames School Board President Sabrina Shields Cook said Monday, "We know that it's going to pass." Given that likelihood, Shields Cook said, "It is a disservice, in my opinion, to our staff and our teachers who have had to go through the process of creating two different models when we know that in a couple of days there is a 99% likelihood that we are going to be required to be 100% in person." The board voted 4-3 last week to keep middle and high school students in a 4-day-week hybrid learning model against the recommendation of Superintendent Jenny Reisner. The board voted in December to move the elementary and preschools to 100% in-person learning, which is 5 days a week for those students, Monday through Friday. The school board voted 6-1 on Monday to return grades 6-12 to fully in-person learning with a remote option. Board member Jamet Colton voted against that move. Ames School District spokesperson Eric Schmidt said, "The one-day difference in schedules between elementary and secondary grades, which will mostly remain once grades 6 through 12 are also fully in person February 1st, is because there are elementary teachers dedicated to students learning remotely, whereas all middle and high school teachers are also responsible for remote learners in their classes." Schmidt said that secondary students will attend Monday through Thursday with about one Friday a month as well. In addition to lawmakers' push, Shields Cook's first reason for her support of the decision to return to fully in-person was improving local COVID-19 indicators, positivity, and case rate data as well as school staff absences not being primarily driven by COVID-19. "We never can predict what's going to happen," she said. "It could be that the new variant is going to hit Iowa. Those numbers are going to go up. It could be that the Iowa State students are going to have an impact on all of that. All we can ever do is make a decision that's based on the numbers that are in front of us right now. And when we had this vote a week ago, the numbers were significantly higher than what they are right now." Iowa State University students' semester began on the same day. More infection variants of the coronavirus that cause COVID-19 are spreading through the world and in the United States, prompting fears of another surge in cases and deaths. While vaccine distribution continues, however, it is delayed by issues including supply. Shields Cook acknowledged that there is still desire in the community to have a hybrid learning option. However, we don't have the ability to give every community member what they want. We don't have the resources. We've not been given the resources to do that by the state legislature. Jeff Hawkins, who is the district's secondary education executive director, and Reisner said on Monday that the district does not have the resources, particularly in staffing, to offer in-person, remote, and hybrid learning models at the same time. Board Vice President Michelle Lenkitis worried that staffing issues would ultimately drive the district to go back to fully remote learning, raising concerns about students' well-being in that scenario. Reisner said going remote, again, because of a lack of teachers and substitutes is a possibility, but there's no way to know whether that will happen. "I'm not a medical expert," she said. "All I am is a superintendent running a school district and trying to do the best that I can for our students." In response to a question from Lentkis, Reisner said the district would work with staff on a case-by-case basis to make accommodations for remote learning. Reisner and Hawkins also said the district is doing the best it can on social distancing, with principals being told to maximize the available space to the extent possible. With precautions, researchers have found that schools can operate safely during the pandemic. Board member Alan Bierbaum said, "I think the federal government's going to step forward with some better recommendations." Our next story comes to us from Rana Faborg. Longtime Story City chef opens events venue in a historic building. A longtime chef has renovated a historic building into an event venue in Story City's downtown. Dawn Retelik, the owner of Dinners by Dawn, has opened Century Venue at 516 Broad Street. Retelik wants to help people make memories of a century in a century-old building, she said, quoting her business motto. The building was constructed in 1903, Retelik said, and has been in her possession for more than a decade as the location of a restaurant, which she closed in September of 2019. "I had this building as a restaurant for more than 10 years, Retelik said. Before that, I was in another location at the end of town for a couple of years. I rented a little building there." Early on, Rentlick's restaurant business grew so quickly, she had to make the decision whether to grow or to scale down, and she chose growth. "I needed more space, so I bought this building in 2011, she said. Rentlick closed her restaurant due to staffing problems. In 2019, there was basically no unemployment, and it just got to where I could not do 80-hour weeks anymore, she said. I didn't have any problem with business, but I was running 100 people a day through for lunch and only had 4 staff. After being closed for 3 or 4 months, Retelik concluded that I needed to do something with this beautiful building. She decided to convert the front half of the building on Broad Street for event rental with her new business called Century Venue. There are not a lot of facilities with the character of this building, she said. There are no 100-year-old buildings where you can have an event. Retelik updated the look of Century Venue with black, gray, and white color themes. The original wood floor is still there, now painted with a glossy black, and the original tin ceiling with its ornate embellishments, and it is white. Large archival photos showing some of the history of the building grace the walls. The venue seats up to 75 guests and features a bar that runs about 3/4 of the length of the room. "We put a lot of care into the 100-plus-year-old building when working on renovations, and we strive to make it a place with extra little things that you may not find in a typical venue space. According to Alex Redelick, the son of Don and Mike Redelick, who is a senior in interior design at Iowa State University. Extra little things include the free use of a commercial ice maker, a microwave and refrigerator during rentals. For a small upgrade, rentals can also include commercial coffee maker and catering equipment. Customers can bring their own food and beverages to the venue. As a designer in the midst of COVID, I focused on the design aspects incorporating all hard, non-porous surfaces, said Alex Redelick. Every single object in the venue can be sanitized properly, allowing events to continue to happen, but happen safely for our community. Rentals are available for a full day or half of a day. Special pricing is available for nonprofit events. Century Venue can be reserved through its Facebook page, Century Venue Story City. At Central Venue Story City. That's the Facebook page address. The back half of the downtown building is Redelick's personal chef service, still called Dinners by Dawn. People can pick up fresh and frozen meals that are take and bake. Before Redelick opened her restaurant in the rented building in 2009, she worked for 2 years as a personal chef. I went to people's homes and made them a week's worth of meals in their homes, she said, and I would leave the meals in their refrigerator. A shoulder injury made it difficult for her to transport the food and the equipment to her clients' homes. She opened her Dinners by Dawn restaurant so that she could cook and her customers would come to her instead of the other way around. Dinners by Dawn now offers professional chef service and take-and-bake meals. That's personal chef service and take-and-bake meals. Redelick has a list of meals available on her Dinners by Dawn Facebook page and also offers custom-made entrees, side dishes, and desserts. She even offers a contactless pickup option. This helped me go full circle back to my roots of being a personal chef, Redelick said. Over the decades, the Century Venue building has been home to a variety of businesses, including Henderson Furniture until about 1940, Jack Spratt Food Store from the 1940s to about 1960, by Low Food Market in the 1960s, American Country Antiques, PJ Fabrics, and Hook and Needle in the 1970s, Wireson Furniture from the 1990s to early 2000s, and then various restaurants for the decade or so before Redelick purchased it for Dinners for Dawn. Redelick said she is excited for the rich history of the building to continue on for the community. My parents were so excited to create a venue space that gives back to the community, that gave them so much success and love the past 20 years, said Alex Redelick. We'll turn now to the printed version of the Ames Tribune. On the front page, there is a picture of a nursing home resident getting a coronavirus shot at the nursing home. And the caption reads, residents and staff members at Madrid Home, a nursing home facility in Madrid, received the first round of Pfizer-BioNTech vaccinations last week. Walgreens pharmacist Haley Perrin of Ida Grove administers the vaccine to home resident Marge Rolfe. The next story comes to us from the Des Moines Register. The Iowa House passes an anti-abortion amendment. This amendment is needed to respond to the judicial overreach of the Iowa Supreme Court. The legislature makes laws. The court interprets laws. That was written by Stephen Holt, who is a Republican from Denison. The measure's sponsor and House lawmakers approved a constitutional amendment saying the Iowa Constitution does not protect abortion rights, achieving a goal that eluded a smaller Republican majority last year. The measure passed the Republican-controlled chamber on a 55-44 vote on Wednesday, after more than 2 hours of debate. Republicans argue the measure would counter the judicial overreach of the Iowa Supreme Court decision that affirmed abortion rights, while Democrats say it would open the door to extreme restrictions on abortion. Republicans proposed a similar measure last year, but House leaders did not bring it up for debate in the full chamber. The party had a 53-47 majority in the House last year, but they now have a larger margin of 59 versus 41. Republican Representatives Jane Bloomingdale, a Republican from Northwood, Lee Hine, a Republican from Monticello, and David Maxwell, a Republican from Gibson, Iowa, joined every Democrat in voting against the measure. Representative Dave Sieck, that's S-I-E-C-K, a Republican from Greenwood, was absent. The measure is likely to pass the Iowa Senate this year, where Republicans hold a 32-18 majority, as it did last year. If the Senate does approve it, the legislature still would need to approve the language of the amendment again in 2023 or 2024 before it could appear on Iowans' ballots in the 2024 election. The language of the proposed constitutional amendment states, quote, "To defend and protect unborn children, we the people of the state of Iowa declare that this Constitution does not recognize, grant, or secure a right to abortion or require the public funding of abortion." Republicans are seeking to nullify a 2018 Iowa Supreme Court decision with the constitutional amendment. The decision found that there is a fundamental right to an abortion in the Iowa Constitution. Republican lawmakers argue the court overstepped its authority with that decision and essentially amended the Constitution by judicial fiat. This amendment is needed to respond to the judicial overreach of the Iowa Supreme Court. The legislature makes laws, the court interprets laws, according to that said by Representative Stephen Holt, a Republican from Denison, who is the measure's sponsor. Democrats said the amendment could endanger women's access to birth control and in vitro fertilization, as well as block the right to have an abortion even in the case of rape, incest, or when a woman's life is in danger. They introduced changes to the amendment during Wednesday's debate, but Republicans voted them down. Without state constitutional protections for abortion, Democrats said Republicans would be emboldened to try to ban the procedure. Previous restrictions Republicans approved, like a 72-hour waiting period to receive an abortion and a ban on abortions after a fetal heartbeat is detected, have been struck down by the courts under the Iowa Constitution. Our next story comes to us from the Associated Press. President Joe Biden on Thursday ordered government health insurance markets to reopen for a special sign-up window, offering uninsured Americans a haven as the spread of COVID-19 remains dangerously high and vaccines are not yet widely available. Biden signed an executive order directing the healthcare.gov insurance market to take new applications for subsidized benefits, something former President Donald Trump's administration had refused to do. He also instructed his administrator to consider reversing other Trump healthcare policies, including curbs on abortion counseling and the imposition of work requirements for low-income people who are receiving Medicaid benefits. "There's nothing new that we're doing here other than restoring the Affordable Care Act and restoring Medicaid to the way it was before Trump became president," Biden said as he signed the directives in the Oval Office. He declared he was reversing my predecessor's attack on women's health. The actions were only the first steps by Biden, who has promised to build out former President Barack Obama's health care law to achieve a goal of coverage for all. While Biden rejects the idea of a government-run system that Senator Bernie Sanders has pushed in his Medicare for All proposal, Biden's more centrist approach will require corresponding seasonal buy-in, but opposition to Obamacare runs deep among Republicans. The most concrete short-term impact of Biden's orders will come from reopening healthcare.gov insurance markets, as coverage has shrunk in the economic turmoil of the coronavirus pandemic. That's an executive action and no legislation is required. The new special enrollment period will begin February 15th and will run through May 15th. It will be coupled with a promotional campaign, as well as a call for states that run their own insurance markets to match the federal sign-up opportunity. Biden also ordered the immediate reversal of a federal policy that bars taxpayer funding for international healthcare nonprofits that promote or provide abortion, known as the Mexico City policy. It can be switched on or off depending on whether Democrats or Republicans control the White House. Abortion rights supporters call it the global gag rule. His decision, while expected, was cheered by abortion choice advocates and some humanitarian groups, denounced but it was denounced by anti-abortion groups. The move also included a restoration of American funding to the UN Population Fund, and it withdraws the U.S. from an international accord that promotes anti-abortion policies. Biden directed the State Department and the Department of Health and Human Services to withdraw from the so-called Geneva Consensus, an October 2020 document signed by 34 countries that sought to promote anti-abortion policies and others deemed pro-family worldwide. Our next story, a robocaller who used Tibbetts' death to spread racist message faces a $9.9 million fine. This story comes to us from Kalispell, Montana. A Montana man is facing a $9.9 million fine from the Federal Communications Commission after he sent racist, anti-Semitic, and harassing robocalls to tens of thousands of phones across eight states. Scott D. Rhodes, age 51, used University of Iowa student Molly Tibbetts' death, among other high-profile topics, to promote a white nationalist message in a 2018 robocall campaign. The Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, announced the fine on January 14th and said Rhodes repeatedly violated the Truth in Caller ID Act by manipulating the calls to make them seem as if they came from local telephone numbers. Authorities say he made 827 robocalls between August 28 and August 30th, 2018. Those calls were made to numbers in Tibbetts' hometown of Brooklyn, Iowa. His message used slurs and urged residents to support the deportation of non-white immigrants. Tibbetts' family members were among those who received the calls just days after she was found stabbed to death by Christian Bahia Rivera, an undocumented Mexican immigrant. He was charged with first-degree murder in the slaying. Bahia Rivera is scheduled to stand trial May 17th after multiple delays caused by COVID-19 and disputes over evidence in the case. In a September 2018 interview with the Des Moines Register, Tibbetts' father, Rob Tibbetts, said that he believed he was among the first to receive the message, which claimed if Molly could be brought back to life, she would say of immigrants, kill them all. It was unbelievably painful, he said. It was everything that's dark and wrong with America right now. The robocall message conveyed views Molly Tibbetts would have considered profoundly racist, her father said. Other robocall campaigns by Rhodes in 2018 targeted Black and Jewish politicians, a journalist, an Iowa community grieving the killing of a college student, and the murder case against an avowed white supremacist who drove into a crowd in Charlottesville, Virginia, the day, this according to the Daily Interlake reporting on Wednesday. Aju Pai, who stepped down as the FCC's chairman last week, said the law clearly bans spoofed robocalls used with the intent to defraud, cause harm, or cheat recipients, and that Rhodes' calls marked new levels of egregiousness. Among many others things, the calls Rhodes sent included a recording of Adolf Hitler and directed listeners to his podcast where he ranted about Jews, Muslims, and other people of color. Calls also went to Charlottesville, Virginia, conveying a baseless conspiracy theory about the death of a woman amid the murder trial of a white supremacist who drove into a crowd in 2017. Rhodes has been given 30 days to pay the fine. If he does not, the FCC said it would refer the case to the Department of Justice. In his response to the commission's findings, Rhodes complained of politically motivated gross overreach of the FCC authority. Rhodes did not immediately return an email requesting comment from the Daily Interlake on Tuesday. Next, we have a couple of brief stories. The first one comes to us from Indianapolis, Indiana. A 17-year-old Indianapolis boy has been charged with murder in the shooting deaths of his father, his stepmother, two teenage relatives, and a 19-year-old pregnant woman in the family's home in Marion County. Marion County Prosecutor Ryan Means announced on Thursday. Raymond Ronald Lee Childs III, arrested Monday, was charged as an adult with six counts of murder, including one count for the death of the woman's unborn child. The baby was due to be born in a week. Childs also faces an attempted murder charge. Next, from Tulsa, Oklahoma, an Oklahoma woman whose two young children wandered from their apartment and drowned has pled guilty to reduced charges in the case. Donashia Renee Willis, age 24, agreed Monday to two child neglect charges in the May 2020 deaths of a three-year-old Miracle Crook and a 21-month-old Tony Cook Jr., according to court records. The charges were reduced from second-degree murder counts. Willis of Tulsa also pled guilty to assaulting a police officer for kicking an investigator. She was sentenced to 10 years in prison. And here's the real-life comic for today. Two women are sitting on the sofa, and they are having some coffee. One of the women is wearing sound-suppressing headphones or noise-reducing headphones. The woman without the headphones says, "Are you guys doing anything special during the quarantine?" And the woman with the headphones says, "Well, my husband is teaching himself to play the banjo." And the lady without the headphones says, "Well, that explains a few things." And here's the Dilbert comic for today. They're in the office, of course. And the woman with the big hair, I don't know her name, but the woman with the big hair is talking to the boss man, the bald guy with almost antler-shaped hair on the side of his head, but otherwise he's bald. And the woman says to the boss, "I'm too hungry to make good decisions. I need a break so I can eat a snack." And the boss says, "How do you know your decisions are bad?" And the woman says, "I'm starting to agree with you." And the boss says, "I don't understand." And the woman says, "Exactly." Next up, we have the coronavirus news briefing. The first item, new U.S. cases of the coronavirus have fallen 35% from their January 11th peak, according to a USA Today analysis of Johns Hopkins data. The average number of daily cases has fallen to about 162,000 from a high earlier of 249,000. And there are positive signs for hospitalization. The COVID Tracking Project said Wednesday that the number of people hospitalized is decreasing in every major region. About 107,000 Americans were hospitalized because of the virus on Tuesday, which is down from a peak of more than 130,000 3 weeks ago. Dr. Anthony Fauci said this week that the improvement appears to be the result of natural peaking and then plateauing after a holiday surge rather than an effect of the vaccine rollout. Obaganya Omenka, who is an associate professor and public health specialist at Butler University in Indianapolis, called the decline in new cases encouraging, but warned that it might not be permanent. The daily death toll remains close to the record highs set earlier this month, an average of about 23,000 each week. Recorded deaths lag the infection rate, but the CDC says it expects deaths to decline over the next 4 weeks. This is the time to take advantage of the window and strive even harder to sustain the downward trend as we gradually tap into the supporting active vaccine, Omenka said. It is still possible for the increase in new cases to return if we prematurely let go of the public health efforts that have been helping us all along. The United States has more than 25.6 million confirmed cases, more than 430,000 deaths, according to Johns Hopkins. In other headlines, vaccine coverage is twice as high among white people on average than black and Latino people, according to a CNN analysis of data from 14 states. They found that Dr. Marcella Nunez-Smith, chairperson of President Joe Biden's COVID-19 Equity Task Force, said in a CNN town hall Wednesday that she has seen a similar pattern already emerging across the country. Next in the series, California will turn over its vaccine distribution to health insurance giant Blue Shield. The state has been one of the slowest in the nation, according to the San Francisco Chronicle. Next in the series, the South African variant of COVID-19 has reached the United States as two cases were identified in South Carolina. There is no evidence infections from the variant cause more severe disease, the CDC said in a statement, adding that preliminary data suggests this variant may spread more easily and quickly than other variants. Next in the series, Good Morning America host Michael Stranahan has tested positive and he is self-quarantining. The Associated Press reported Stranahan is not experiencing severe symptoms, according to the Associated Press. Next in the series, the Sinclair Broadcasting Group says it is ending its America This Week show with Eric Bolling, which has been criticized for misstatements. One episode pulled in July included a conspiracy theorist who suggested Dr. Anthony Fauci manufactured the virus and shipped it to China. There is no evidence to back up that theory. Next story. Federal prisons in North Carolina and Michigan struggled to contain outbreaks of, as well as staffing shortages and insufficient quarantine space, which compromised the response, an internal Justice Department review has found. At the Bureau of Prisons complex in Butner, North Carolina, where 26 inmates and one staffer have died since June, authorities were unable to fully restrict staff movements to guard against cross-contamination, while social distancing proved difficult because of the open design of the facilities, according to the Inspector General. As COVID-19 spread throughout two of the complex's institutions, these institutions were not able to guarantee all inmates meeting the criteria for quarantine, largely due to a shortage of space, according to the report. In a written response, federal prison officials disputed the quarantine problems, asserting that, despite the high volume of infections, authorities did meet the guidelines. Our next article asks the question, is COVID arm red rash a cause for concern? An angry red rash being called COVID arm is a harmless but annoying response in some people who get the Moderna vaccine. Aside from sometimes being itchy, it does not appear to be dangerous, and people who get it should not hesitate to get their second dose of the vaccine, excuse me, according to doctors. There is no indication, according to doctors, that the reaction is anything but a topical and brief response as the body's immune system goes to work, according to Dr. Esther Freeman, Director of Global Health Dermatology at Massachusetts General Hospital. We want to reassure people that this is a known phenomenon, she said. Having a big red splotch on your arm for a couple of days may not be fun, but the reality is there is no need to panic and no reason not to get your second shot. Freeman is the principal investigator in the Global COVID-19 Dermatological Registry, which is collecting case reports of people experiencing COVID-19 responses. So far, there are only 14 examples in the registry, but she thinks there are more that have not been reported. Dermatologists and allergists are studying the side effect, which they have tentatively dubbed delayed cutaneous hypersensitivity. Lay people are calling it COVID arm. The rash is red, sometimes itchy and painful to the touch. It can be as much as 5 or 6 inches across. It always occurs on the arm where the shot was given. It's temporarily dramatic, but it will go away within 24 hours to a week, Freeman said. The specific reaction has occurred only in people who have gotten the Moderna vaccine, not the Pfizer vaccine, Freeman said. A small number of the rash reactions were reported in Moderna's clinical trials. It does not mean you should get Pfizer instead of Moderna, she said. It's not such a big deal. The rash also seems to be more common in women, but it's hard to tell because the first people who got the Moderna vaccine were healthcare workers, the majority of whom tend to be women. We do have more cases that are being reported in women, but that could be that women are more likely to tell you, said Dr. Keith Blumenthal, who is an allergist and an epidemiologist and professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. It also seems to be most common in people in their 30s and 40s, but that too could be due to the age of the healthcare workers getting the first wave of the vaccinations. Overall, women account for 77% of the Moderna vaccine's reported side effects, with a median age of 43. That is likely because of the population of healthcare workers who first got the vaccine, according to Dr. Tom Shimbukuru, the U.S. Public Health Service Vaccine Safety Team lead for the COVID-19 response at the CDC. He spoke Wednesday at a meeting of CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. COVID-19 vaccine reactions can be reported to the CDC's V-Safe page. So far, side effects for both vaccines seem to be almost identical, apart from this one particular reaction, the red arm. Data has shown older people have a weaker immune response to the COVID-19 vaccines, so it is possible that the rash simply signals a more robust immune response in younger age groups, Freeman said. It would not be surprising to me because we see different responses to COVID in different age groups, she said. What's unusual is that the rash typically shows up 5 to 9 days after the first immunization, on average a week later. That makes it different from most vaccine side effects, which typically occur within a day or two. People are a little surprised because it's a long time after the shot, Freeman said. Allergic reactions typically become worse with more exposure, so there is a concern that the second shot might cause a more severe rash. Data is still being collected, but doctors are encouraged that does not appear to be the case with the second Moderna shot. However, there are not many examples so far because second shots began only last week. Moderna's vaccine was first authorized December 18. The second dose is not given until 28 days later, so the second round began just only on January 15th. Blumenthal said the rash appears to be a delayed allergic reaction of unknown cause. Is this related to the body's immune reaction? It's just your body doing the job? Or is it maybe related to one of the inactive ingredients in the vaccine? We really don't know yet, she said. The percentage of people who developed the reaction is not known. Blumenthal, who is in charge of allergy for the employee vaccination program at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, said she's seen a fair number. We're probably just seeing the tip of the iceberg, she said. You are listening to the Ames Tribune on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and it is time for us to turn to the obituaries. Ellen Ruth Church, age 97, of Nevada, passed away Tuesday, January 26th, at her home near Nevada. Ellen was born July 18, 1923, in St. Joseph, Missouri, the daughter of William Henry and Carrie Edith Vogel Wagenfield. On September 12, 1948, she was united in marriage to Hubert M. Church in St. Joseph, Missouri. Ellen earned her associate's degree from Missouri Western and her bachelor's and master's degrees from KU. In her early years, she taught high school English and music in Kansas, and once she started a family, Ellen taught piano lessons in her home. Ellen was a devoted and faithful member of Cornerstone Baptist Church in Ankeny, where she was the church pianist and she taught Sunday school and Bible study. Ellen enjoyed tending to her garden and flowers, as well as reading. She also enjoyed traveling, mostly day trips with her family. Ellen is survived by her children, David Church of Cedar Rapids, Martha Church of Nevada, and Don and Catherine Church of Cedar Rapids. Her grandchildren, Ari, Samantha Church, Brian and Julie Church, Jonathan and Lindsay Church, Caitlin and Kyle Wepler, and Rachel Church, as well as her great-grandchildren, Beatrix, Lena, Lillian, Emma, and Oliver. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband, her daughter, Margaret Ray, her brother, Quentin Wagenfield, her daughter-in-law, Cheryl Church, and her granddaughter, Anna Church, in infancy. A visitation will be held at 9:30 in the morning on Monday, February 1st, at Cornerstone Baptist Church, located at 701 East 1st Street in Ankeny, until the funeral service begins at 11 o'clock. The service will be recorded and will be uploaded to the tribute wall for Ellen on the Rasmussen Ryan Funeral Home website. Burial will be at 1 p.m. Tuesday, February 2nd, at Memorial Park Cemetery in St. Joseph, Missouri. Memorial contributions may be made to Cornerstone Baptist Church in memory of Ellen. Rasmussen Ryan Funeral Home in Nevada is handling the arrangements. Condolences may be sent to the family at www.rasmussenfh.com. Our next obituary, Elizabeth Betty Wright of Ames, passed away on January 27th, 2021 at Heartwood House due to COVID-19. A memorial service will be scheduled at a later date. Betty was born on April 23, 1932, to Charles E. and Alice Libby Johnson in Newton, Massachusetts. Before she entered high school, she and her family moved to Portland, Maine. Betty graduated from Deering High School in Portland, Maine in 1950. She worked for an insurance company and the Episcopal Diocese of Maine. In 1951, Betty met a young American, a young airman, Air Force person by the name of Herbert Wright from Michigan, as he stationed at Fort Williams in Cape Elizabeth, Margie, during the Korean conflict. That's Cape Elizabeth, Maine, during the Korean War conflict. Following a courtship that took place through the mail, as Herb was stationed in different places and returned to Michigan to start college again, Herb and Betty were married at Woodsford Congregational Church in Portland, Maine, on August 28, 1954. Herb completed his Bachelor of Science and his Master of Science degrees at Michigan State University, while Betty worked for the university. Daughter Anne and son John were born in Lansing, Michigan, before the family moved to Ames. At that time, the families wondered aloud about the unknown world of Iowa. After the kids were in school, Betty went to college at Iowa State University and became active in a new organization for adult students on campus. She was named Outstanding Adult Student in 1975. She graduated with a Bachelor of Arts degree in Journalism and Mass Communications in 1975. She did graduate work in English as a Second Language, or ESL. Betty was an active member of the Ames community over the years. She was active at both Northminster Presbyterian Church and later at Collegiate Presbyterian Church. Betty served as an elder, a Christian education recruiter, and many committees at Northminster. Betty served on the Rummage Committee at Collegiate for many years. Betty was active with the Friends of Foreign Wives, including tutoring women in English. She was a part of Beyond Welfare and served on the Bicycle Committee as they advised the City Council. She was a hospice volunteer. She was an active member of Iowa State University's Women's Club. After she and Herb retired, they spent winters in Florida and then Texas. In summers, they enjoyed their favorite place in the world, Wilderness State Park, just outside of Mackinac City, Michigan. In addition to these times on the road, Betty's greatest joy was spending time with her family. After Betty was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, she participated in research projects with the kinesiology department at Iowa State. She enjoyed ballroom dancing, singing, and boxing as a research participant. Betty is survived by her husband of 66 years, Herb, daughter Ann Johnson Monroe, a son, John and Linda Wright Carmel in Indiana. That's John and Linda Wright of Carmel, Indiana. Six grandchildren, Melinda and Aaron Bryant of Ames, Lauren and Doug Zhang of Carmel, Indiana, Stephanie Wright, Chicago, Illinois, Erin Rouse, Des Moines, Tyler Wright, Carmel, Indiana, and Kaylee Rouse, Ypsilant, Michigan. Three great-grandchildren, Adian and Genevieve Bryan, Grimes and Carolyn Zhang, Carmel, Indiana, one sister, Grace Craig of Amherst, Massachusetts, and one brother, David Johnson of Acton, A-C-T-O-N, Massachusetts. She is preceded in death by her parents, her stepmother, Lucille Johnson, and two sisters, Cynthia Ward and Alice Park. The family requests no flowers. Memorials should be directed to the Iowa State Foundation to Parkinson's Disease Research for Kinesiology at Iowa State University. Online condolences may be directed to www.grandinfuneralandcremationcare.com. Our next story comes to us from the Associated Press. General Motors Corporation sets a goal of going largely electric by the year 2035. General Motors has set a goal of making the vast majority of its vehicles that they produce electric by the year 2035, and the entire company carbon neutral, including operations, 5 years after that. The Detroit automaker's push into electric vehicles has gone into overdrive this year. GM has already announced that it will invest $27 billion in electric and autonomous vehicles in the next 5 years, a 35% increase over plans made before the pandemic. It will offer 30 all-electric models worldwide by the middle of the decade. By the end of 2025, 40% of all U.S. models will be battery electric vehicles. The company plans to include crossovers, SUVs, sedans, and trucks in its electric vehicle lineup. GM said Thursday that it will source 100% renewable energy to power its U.S. sites by the year 2030 and global sites by the year 2035. That is 5 years faster than its previously announced global goal. And it has a goal of making all new light-duty vehicles, the vast majority of its fleet, fully electric within 14 years. The company will concentrate on offering zero-emission vehicles in different price ranges. It's also working with others, including the Environmental Defense Fund, to build the necessary infrastructure to power its electric vehicles and to promote their use. To account for carbon emissions that it cannot eliminate, GM expects to invest in carbon credits or offsets. The 112-year-old auto company unveiled a new corporate logo this month to signify its new direction as it openly pivots to electric vehicles. It wants to be seen as a clean vehicle company rather than a builder of cloud-spewing gas-powered pickups and SUVs. GM scrapped its old square blue logo for a lowercase GM surrounded by rounded corners and an M that looks like an electric plug. It also announced a new partnership with Microsoft this month with the hopes of accelerating its rollout of electric self-driving cars. GM's push for carbon neutrality comes one day after President Joe Biden signed executive orders that include moving to an all-electric federal vehicle fleet. His goal is to transform the nation's heavily fossil fuel-powered economy into a clean, burning one. Our next story comes to us from the Associated Press. The dateline is Jerusalem, Israel. Ultra-Orthodox unrest threatens Netanyahu's re-election. As he seeks re-election, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has turned to a straightforward strategy. Count on the rock-solid support of his ultra-Orthodox political allies and stamp out the coronavirus pandemic with one of the world's most aggressive vaccination campaigns. But with ultra-Orthodox communities openly flouting safety guidelines and violent clashing with police turning to enforce them, this marriage of convenience is turning into a burden. Netanyahu has watched his political partners undermine the country's war against the virus and spark a public backlash that threatens him at the ballot box. Netanyahu's hope is that Israel will be the first country in the world to be vaccinated and that he will be able to open the economy to everyone, ultra-Orthodox and secular, and then the problem will be forgotten. That according to Moshe Klugaft, a campaign strategist who has advised Netanyahu in the past. If the current troubles persist, he said, Netanyahu will be in big trouble. Less than 2 months before the March 23rd election, Israel finds itself in a paradoxical situation. In just 1 month, it has vaccinated over one quarter of its 9.3 million people and is on pace to inoculate the entire adult population by election day. At the same time, it has one of the developing world's highest rates of infection, with some 8,000 new cases detected each day. This week, it tightened a month-old lockdown by closing its international airport to nearly all flights. There are a number of reasons for the ongoing outbreak. Before the airport was shuttered, Israelis returned from abroad. They were bringing back with them fast-spreading variants of the coronavirus. Other segments of the population have also failed to comply with lockdown provisions that have closed stores, schools, and restaurants. But there is little question that the ultra-Orthodox sector, where schools remain open, synagogues are full, and mass weddings and funerals continue to take place. That has been a driving force in the spiking numbers. Experts estimate that the sector, making up about 12% of Israel's population, accounts for 40% of the new COVID-19 cases. Official data also shows that vaccination rates in ultra-Orthodox towns, where science often takes a back seat to faith, are well below the rest of the country. The ultra-Orthodox have long wielded disproportionate influence in Israel, using their kingmaker status in parliament to extract concessions from the nation's leaders. Ultra-Orthodox males are exempt from otherwise mandatory military service. The community schools receive generous subsidies while providing subpar education that focuses almost entirely on religious studies and ignores critical subjects like mathematics, English, and science. Our next story comes to us from the Associated Press, the Dateline Providence, Rhode Island. Checked by reality, some QAnon conspiracy supporters want out. Celia Smith spent a year down the rabbit hole of QAnon, spending more and more time researching and discussing the conspiracy theory online. Eventually, it consumed her and she wanted out. She broke up with the boyfriend who recruited her into the movement. She took 6 months off of social media and turned to therapy and yoga. I was like, I can't live this way. I'm a single mother, working, going to school, and doing the best for my children, said Smith, who is 32 and lives in Kansas City, Missouri. I personally didn't have the bandwidth to do this and show up for my children. Even if it was all true, I just couldn't do it anymore. More than a week after Donald Trump departed the White House, shattering their hopes that he would expose the worldwide cabal, some QAnon adherents have concocted ever more elaborate stories to keep their faith alive. But others, like Smith, are turning to therapy and online support groups to talk about the damage done when their beliefs collided with reality. The QAnon conspiracy theory emerged on fringe internet message boards in 2017. At the root, the movement claims Trump is waging a secret battle against the deep state and a sect of powerful, devil-worshipping pedophiles who dominate Hollywood, big business, the media, and government. It is named after Q, who is an anonymous poster who believers claim has top-secret government clearance and whose posts are taken as predictions about the plan and the coming storm and, quote, Great Awakening, unquote, in which evil will be defeated. Backers of the movement were vocal in their support for Trump and helped fuel the insurrectionists who overran the U.S. Capitol earlier this month. QAnon is also growing in popularity overseas. Former believers interviewed by the Associated Press liken the process of leaving QAnon to kicking a drug addiction. QAnon, they say, offers simple explanations for a complicated world and creates an online community that provides escape and even friendship. Smith's then boyfriend introduced her to QAnon. It was all he could talk about, she said. At first, she was skeptical, but she became convinced after the death of financier Jeffrey Epstein while in federal custody facing pedophile charges. Officials debunked theories that he was murdered, but to Smith and other QAnon supporters, his suicide while facing child sex charges was too much to accept. Soon, Smith was spending more time on fringe websites and on social media. She was reading and posting about the conspiracy theory. She said she felt for QAnon content that presented no evidence. She said she fell for QAnon content that presented no evidence, no counterarguments, and yet was all too convincing. We as a society need to start teaching our kids to ask, where is this information coming from, and can I trust it? She said. Anyone can cut and paste anything. After a while, Smith wanted out. Suffocated by dark prophecies that were taking up more and more of her time, and they were leaving her terrified. Her then-boyfriend saw her decision to move on as a betrayal. She said she wanted to share her story in the hopes that it would help others. I was one of those people too, she said, of QAnon and its grip. I came out on the other end because I wanted to feel better. Another ex-believer, Jatartha Kwajeda, created a Reddit forum called QAnon Casualties to help others like him as well as relatives of people still consumed by the theory. Membership has doubled in recent weeks to more than 114,000 members. Three new moderators had to be added just to keep up. There are our friends and family, said Jahida. who is from Sydney, Australia. It's not about who is right or who is wrong. I'm here to preach empathy for the normal people, the good people, who got brainwashed by this death cult. His advice to those fleeing QAnon is get off social media, take deep breaths, and pour that energy and internet time into local volunteering. Michael Frank is a Mississippi computer engineer who now moderates a QAnon recovery channel on the social media platform called Telegram. He said that while mocking the group has never been more popular online, it will only further alienate people. Frank said he never believed in the QAnon theory, but sympathizes with those who did. I think after the inauguration, a lot of them realized they've been taken for a ride, he said. These are human beings. If you have a loved one who is in it, make sure they know that they are loved. QAnon supporters are likely to respond in three general ways as reality undermines their beliefs, according to Ziv Cohen, a forensic psychiatrist and an expert on extremist beliefs at Weill Cornell Medical College of Cornell University. Those who only dabble in the conspiracy theory may shrug and move on, Cohen said. At the other extreme, some militant believers may migrate to radical anti-government groups and plot potentially violent crimes. Indeed, some QAnon believers have already done so. In the middle, he said, are many followers who looked to QAnon to help them make sense of the world, to help them feel a sense of control. These people may simply revise QAnon's elastic narrative to fit reality rather than face up to being hoodwinked. This isn't about critical thinking, of having the hypotheses and using facts to support it, Cohen said, of QAnon believers. They have a need for these beliefs, and if you take that away, because the storm did not happen, they could just move the goalpost. And that brings us to the conclusion of reading the Ames Tribune for this Friday, January 29th. Your reader today has been Dave Sowerman. Thank you for listening to Iris.